Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. This is my second go of doing the intro because I embarrassed myself the first time. I'm not going to say what I did, though. But I am joined by Matt Jones.
Hi, how's it going?
It's good. How embarrassing did you find my original intro?
Horrid.
And also, we have Emma Matthews with us. Emma, how you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks. Hello.
Hello, hello. We've got a bit of a weird week this week. We sort of found ourselves in between things. Obviously, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is out today when you're listening to this. And, or was it yesterday? I suppose it came out on the 29th. Doesn't matter. It's out right now.
They're probably all trying to kiss Tifa as we speak. Absolutely. We're just on in the background.
But we spoke about that game for a good chunk last week. So I don't think we wanted to die. You guys are not playing it, right? Or you don't intend to play it? Is that...
I think I'm going to pick up a PS5 soon, and I think I'll play the previous one and this one as well. Although I hear maybe that's not a necessity as well. Maybe you can just jump right into this one.
I guess it depends on how familiar you are with the original, right? If you're familiar with the original, then you could probably jump into Rebirth. But I would also watch a recap of the ending of Remake. But yeah, I'd say play Remake as well. Emma, how about yourself? Are you interested in it at all?
Not really. I feel like right now I'm the only person in the world who isn't like a Final Fantasy fan. It feels like it's massive and I'm just kind of watching it from the outside. I might get around to them at some point, but yeah, not immediately.
They're pretty big investments, and some of them are kind of ancient. Like, I really love, I think 8's amazing, but those first like 7-10 hours of it are properly like just menus after menus after menus. Is so boring.
I was thinking about replaying 8 because I only ever played it when it very first came out, and I never finished it because I found it quite disappointing. Like, I think I forced myself through it because I love 7 so much, and then I just gave up at some point. So
yeah,
maybe one day I'll go back.
It's a very different game, that's the thing. But it's also, you know, it's very good. I think it's underrated. I like 9 the most, and I think that you agree, right?
I absolutely love 9, but 9 is a tough sell to a lot of people, especially when they'd come off the back of sort of like moody, emo, future sci-fi versions, and then they went to full.
He's a lad with a tail.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a little man in a robe.
But 9 fucking goes places.
Yeah, it's weird.
Different things. But yeah, I don't think we're ever going to see a remake of that. But you never know. Like, I could absolutely, once the Final Fantasy VII remake is finished, all three are done, I could absolutely see a groundswell for 8, and maybe 10 years down the line would finally get that remake.
It'd be so funny to do 9 first and then go back to 8 as well.
Anyway, we're not going to talk about Final Fantasy, even though we just talk about it for about 5 minutes. But we have got some other things. We've got a TV show, we've got a demo that we've checked out, we've got exciting trailers for new games, and much to the request of our audience, we are going to bring back the Endless Search today. So you will get to hear the Endless Search theme again, I promise. It'll be later on in the podcast. But first, Matt, tell us about Shogun.
Well, First of all, it's utterly brilliant. You don't even need me to tell you anything about this. Just get it on immediately. It's on Disney Plus because it's from FX. It is a limited series about a pivotal time in Japanese history. It's in the exactly 1600. Like, that's the year it happens. Right. And that is such a weird time in history where, like, kind of everything happens at once. And yet I knew pretty much nothing about it. Like, I knew the outskirts of it, right? Like, broadly. Also, if you go watch the Bill Wirtz History of Japan video, a very popular one, this takes up like 20 seconds of it, despite it being like a 9-minute video and it being super important. It's like, after the events of this TV show, the country totally closes its borders to foreigners for 250 years. Yeah. And I've kind of always been like, well, how does a country decide to do that? Like, what systems would have to be in place for them to like decide like, oh no, we're totally isolated, we're just doing our own thing. And it turns out that it's about like, it's the struggle of the new shogun trying to be brought into power. And this show is about the first English person that arrives on the shores during that time. But it's also 60 years after the Portuguese have already had merchants and Catholic missionaries there. And so just with that framing alone, you can tell that there's a lot of vast conflict of people having conflicting aims. And so, like, it allows, with this English guy there, the show has this, like, he's a fish out of water. And so the strangeness of this environment and all of the machinations can be explained to this guy. But mostly the important thing is just, like, everybody is sort of after something. And they all are just trying to kill each other to get it. It's very, people will describe it as very Game of Thronesy, but it's quite grounded and political, like all the best stuff.
So it's Game of Thronesy in terms of it's everybody vying for power and wanting to cut each other's throat. Like, yeah, I said, the politics of it, as opposed to magical dragons breathing fire.
Exactly. I haven't seen the dragon yet. Maybe it'll show up at some
point. Is it all its best foot forward in terms of historical accuracy?
The interesting thing is that it's based on a book from the 70s. That is pretty much accurate to the time period, but they've changed the names somewhat. It won't be about the setting up of the Tokugawa shogunate. It'll be about like whatever they've named this guy. And the English guy, he's named something else in real life, but in this one, he's, you know, whatever he's called. But it is pretty much accurate to the time period.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Emma, you've watched it as well, right?
I've watched the first episode. I think there's two episodes out so far. The first episode is really good. Like, I wanted to watch the second one last night, but it was too late and I had to go to bed. But yeah, like you said, it's kind of Game of Thronesy, and like, it's very tense immediately because everyone has like sort of working in their own like self-interest. Mm-hmm. At any moment, it feels like someone's going to stab someone else in the back already, like from very early on. And it's kind of the same in like, you get thrown in the deep end from like the very beginning of the first episode of like, there's all these different people. You're sort of getting very quick glimpses of who they are and sort of some stuff they've been through. And then it's right into like, okay, there's tension between these characters and everyone so far. What I really like is like, everyone's in like sort of a high position of power. So the stakes are high, but everyone's also like incredibly two-faced of like, you can see them talking to each other, being very civil and smiling, and you can see that on their faces. So much is like left unsaid. You know that they just want to immediately like sort of say something, but that'll start a conflict, and like that tension's through the entire first episode, which makes it like really exciting.
There's a really good moment in the second episode where a character like speaks out of turn about something. It's like the rest of the guys on the council might think this, and then the person says like, how dare you insult them, but continue. Like, you know,
yeah.
The politeness is what you're supposed to do, but it's like, oh well, you know, I'll hear you out.
Matt, you intrigued me the other day when you were describing it, the fact that you said once you'd finished the episodes, you went down a massive Wikipedia hole.
Yeah, I got in from, I watched Poor Things as well.
Want to see that.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, fantastic little movie. We got home and it's about midnight and we're like, oh, should we put this like shogun on? We're like, all right, cool, not ready to go to bed yet. Finish it. And then I'm like, all right, cool. Can't put the second one on yet, but I just scroll on Wikipedia for like an hour and a half. I woke up so tired the next day, but I'm just like learning about shogunate and what a koku is. Like, you can tell there is a line of dialogue that's like, oh, this guy, he's got like 500 koku. And I'm like, what the hell is that? And it doesn't bother to explain it. And it's like, a koku is a grain, is how much rice a person would need to survive for an entire year. Right. And that is a unit of koku. So if you've got that much of it, then that's how powerful you are.
It's some of my favorite memories of watching films and TV shows that I've really loved are the Wikipedia holes I go into afterwards and just try, because I'm just so into the idea. I just want to learn more. I want to get more information about it. So hearing you saying that makes me think I need to check this show out, especially because of obviously the quick description of Game of Thrones, like, is obviously going to pique my interest anyway, but it looks visually, it looks really interesting and cool as well. So when's the next episode coming out?
Weekly, so I think Thursday. Okay. So yeah, you've got two to get before then. Yeah, the end of the last episode, I was like, why haven't I got another one to get immediately?
It does make me think I might wait until the season's finished then. And
I don't know. So maybe we feel different ways about this, but I like that feeling that I can't have it immediately. Like, I can just like, I'm just feeling the weight of the episode that I've just watched for a week before I, you know, get the next one.
Yeah, there is back in the early 2000s, the Lost days, I suppose, when it was weekly television, there was a lot of, I think you got more value out of every episode because you would rewatch the episode or you'd just be thinking about that one episode, as opposed to modern era, Netflix era, where it's you can easily forget about one episode, it all sort of blurs into one. So I do see the value there. I just don't know if... I know what I'm like. I'd be impatient all week for it.
I've just realised, though, that the fact that it is historical fiction, it means that you can just spoil it for, like, learning too much history. Like, if you've got to wait a week to know what happens, you can learn what's going to happen.
But how slavish are they to it? Like, it's a long time ago. Like, it's obviously, they're going to have, like, poetic licence to a certain degree, right?
Yeah, that's very true. But, you know, like, the Battle of Sekigahara is going to happen maybe in the final episode of this show, right? Like, that's not going to not happen, right? Like,
I mean, I know a thing that's going to happen in House of the Dragon, but I'm still very excited to see how they do it and how they put it together. So, I'm torn. I do really want to see it, but then I also think I might really enjoy binging it. So I think maybe I'll let a couple of episodes play out. Then I'll try watching three or four back to back and see how I feel.
Yeah.
Because that might burn me out on it, doing that much in that amount of time. Intensive in terms of like, it demands your attention, I suppose.
Most of the dialogue, I'd say about 50-50, is split between Japanese and English, you will have to be watching it for subtitles. Also, it's really interesting that no one is actually speaking English, they're all speaking Portuguese, but they're just choosing to translate it as English because, like, you'd be hearing Portuguese the whole show as well as English, as Japanese, which is just an interesting choice. I was just trying to think about, like, whether the Portuguese film industry ever blew up at some point, whether they'd still make this show, but they do it totally accurate rather than in English.
Did they do that thing what shows used to do where they lay the groundwork, like, they speak Portuguese, but for your benefit, we're going to change it into English.
They don't say it, but you just pick up instantly. Yeah.
Okay.
Emma, did you get the impression as well, the main character... He feels to me as if, like, they cloned Tom Hardy, but it's the Tom Hardy that he gets to do his washing.
I'm not sure, really.
He's, like, nearly Tom Hardy, right? But he's not, you know, he's not kind really of. It.
He's got, like, a Tom Hardy kind of essence to him. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure, like... I think what's really cool about the first episode as well is because you don't know any of the characters yet and you are just thrown in, it's like, I'm not sure exactly who I'm rooting for yet. I don't know who, like, I like, and, you know, I don't necessarily know if there is a good and a bad side in this just yet that I want to side with. But, there are a few characters immediately that I've taken a liking to. I'm not sure. That's the thing with these kind of shows. We've had a couple, like, gruesome deaths already, and not I'm really. Sure there's going to be more. You know, I feel like it's one of those ones where anyone could be killed off at any second. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. I think, like, the main character, the Tom Hardy kind of guy, I'm not sure if I like him yet. I'm unsure about him right now.
It is interesting because his characterization is that he's kind of a brute. Like, he's kind of like, he isn't like civil, right? But he's in a society where he doesn't really know what that means, which is such an interesting like framing for the character, because he's almost like inevitably at odds with everybody else that's in the world just from who he is, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, like they have like a scene sort of right at the end of the first episode as well, where he's on like this boat and he's going to Osaka, and they're like, oh, like that he's basically being told like, this is not what you're expecting. This place is like incredible. Mm. And like, I think he sort of arrives in this new place where he's never been before, and he's expecting the worst and expecting it to not be like sort of what he's used to and not be sort of, you know, civilization on his level. And basically they immediately, the person who he's talking to is like, no, you have no idea about this place. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool.
I don't like to go on about it, but I have been to Japan. And so I've been to Osaka Castle, and like the representation of how they walk through the gates and everything is pretty much one-to-one. Like it is like having that perspective of like what that actually looks like does mean that I'm appreciating it from a technical level, but I'm also like, oh, it would be amazing to do this. Yeah. Like if this lad comes from England at that time, there's nothing that looks like anything like that.
Well, I mean, it's a culture shock going to Japan in the era of globalization. Like, imagine what it was in terms of culture shock back then. Would have been like fucking going into an alien planet or something.
Yeah, totally. Insane. Check it out. Shogun, yes, Disney Plus.
Definitely want to check this out. It sounds like it's a new hotness that everyone's going to be into potentially. Is Unicorn Overlord the new hotness?
It's niche.
Overlord.
Tell so us about it. It's being produced by Vanillaware, who've had like a bunch of really niche hits for a while. I played Odin Sphere about, I don't know, 20 years ago at this point, and it's a game for the PS2, kind of an action side-scrolling battler, but it's also got this weird system where you plant trees and then enemy souls will go into the trees and then they become potion ingredients you can then use in order to level yourself up and stuff like that. Right. Really cool, like really inventive design. And so they've had that kind of design lineage for the rest of the stuff that they've done. The last game before this was called 13 Sentinels. Yes. It's like a mech game that's also got like a bunch of like visual novel story stuff to it. That's really cool. And so with that in mind, I was like, oh, let's check out like the new like thing that they've got coming out. It's been in a couple of Nintendo Directs. They've got, it's a fantasy setting and it's a tactical RPG, but not really how Fire Emblem or something would do that. Right. Instead, it's not on a grid. You're putting units on the field, and you've got, well, actually, you're putting squads on the field, and those squads are made out of your Fire Emblem-y, like, style units.
Yeah.
And so they're in, like, maybe four squads on the map going into battles, and that is most of where the combat exists. And so those squads, every time that you go into battle, you can change the formation of the units. So you want to try and make it so that like your archers need to be at the back lines, and if the enemies have pikes that will go through units, then you want to like split them up so they're not all being attacked at once. And they all attack like an auto battler, but so you want to try and put them in the order that the right one will attack first, stuff like that. Really like in-depth strategy stuff. I'm a total pervert for it. I'm ready. Like, I'm going to spend quite a lot of time doing this.
That just sounds like RTS fodder. Like, but I'm looking at some images of it, and what ones where it looks like 2D fighters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're doing the overground stuff, and then when you get into battle, it looks like the 2D fighting.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. And so, like, there's some strategy of, like, you can only do about 6 fights with any squad before they get tired. And then when they get tired, they're open to ambush. So you're like managing your resources of when you're using certain people. And then there's the like rock, paper, scissors of if they have a flying unit, you want to use an archer against it. And then like flying units are really good against cavalry, that kind of deal. So all of that, like really cool. I can see this being something that I sink a lot of time into. This is cool overworld thing where you're like getting towns that you're saving them from other places, but then different places have different items that you can grab. A whole lot of like really intense systems that is going to like totally destroy my year.
Yeah.
Only problem with this one there's like really, there's a lot of chat on Twitter about this being really badly localized. Like all the dialogue kind of sucks.
Okay.
And I don't really care if the localization is bad, right? I just like, even if it's a direct translation, I'm like, none of this is very good. And I've just been skipping it, and it feels like a total shame. Like that, I'm only gonna take half of the game. Like I literally can't listen to the dialogue. It's so purple. Like it just sucks, and I really hate it. I'm like, it would be nice for a game to be nice. I suppose. I'm saying.
I mean, I play a lot of games where I end up deciding at one point, I hate this story, I hate this dialogue, but I have a good time playing the game, so I just end up skipping stuff. And I think there's value still in just enjoying a gameplay loop and not having to take in the entire thing. But yeah, it'd be nice if everything was good. What is it about this game? Is it doing anything particularly unique? Because it doesn't seem like it.
I think it's just that it's a mesh of a bunch of different genres. Like it's at once an auto battler, at once a tactics RPG, at once a like Total War style unit input thing. And it's got kind of like dating sim-esque stuff of like when your units are in the same squad together, then they'll have relationship and then they'll grow in their compatibility and stuff like that.
Is it called Unicorn Overload or Overlord?
Overlord, yeah.
Okay, right. Because I'm seeing a few places where it says Overload. On the running order, it says Overload. I wrote that, I think. But then when I've Googled it, it says Overlord. And I'm getting confused. Yeah, it's Overlord. Yeah, sorry. Unicorn Overload is the game we're talking about.
As a whole, this one, like, maybe less easy to say that this one's worth picking up, but, like, 13 Sentinels was really cool. I should really check that one out first. And, you know, if you want to go back far enough and you're, like, really into this idea, Odin Sphere was so cool.
Cool. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people that are into these type of games, and I'm sure that's a solid recommendation for them. What else have we got? Helldivers 2. We're still on the Helldivers train
until they release Helldivers 3.
Yeah, so I finally got to play it this week. I can't really offer anything that the guys haven't already said about this game. You know, like, it's obviously a lot of fun, but one experience I did have is I tried play, so I don't have a lot of time at the moment to jump into multiplayer sessions, because that means organizing time with friends, and I don't really have that flexibility at the moment. But what I do have is like an hour of peace in the evening where I can just play a game on my own for a bit, which is great if it's a single player game. Not so great if you're playing Helldivers 2, let me tell you. You can matchmake with random people, which I've ended up doing, and that's fine. You can get through the process there. But I thought, I wonder what it's like actually on my own, just like diving in on my own. Let me tell you, it is a miserable, lonely experience. I mean, all the fun to be had with this game, like, for me, how do I best describe this? It's the craziness of the situation, in terms of everything. It always feels like it's just out of control, and you're never quite in control. And your planet, I always have the intention of, I'm going to go up, look at this area, see where a spawn of bugs come, and then that's when I'm going to drop an orbital strike. Mm-hmm. And it never, ever, ever goes to plan like that. And oftentimes, all your team end up throwing like three different types of orbital strikes all at the same time.
And it's all hitting the same place. It's useless. Yeah.
Or, like I ended up doing when I was playing with Wes, Matt, and Cardi, is hitting them lots of times with my orbital strikes, because I hadn't quite got to grips with how far to throw the grenade. Yeah, I was sort of learning the systems. And when we got a stat screen at the end, it showed that I'd done 12,000 friendly fire damage. But that's part of the fun, and that's part of the charm. I'm like, I don't think I ever saw a point when we were playing together where I killed somebody or somebody killed me and it wasn't funny.
Yeah, no one's upset. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Because you can respawn in. Obviously, you can be called back in so easily and so quickly. And you get quite... I don't know what it's like on harder difficulties, but on the difficulties I played, you get quite a generous amount of respawns.
You get more based on how many people are with you, but the difficulty doesn't change it. You don't get fewer. There might be, like... so there are world... like, something that will, like, change depending on what planet you're on. So maybe some of those will be, like, you have fewer reinforcements for whatever reason. I don't know if that's true. I could imagine that being on a planet. We had a really funny one last night. I had a scrambler... So you're trying to call your stratagems, but you don't always get the one that you've deliberately tried to select.
Cool.
So you have to check that you've gotten the right one before you throw it. So you can like be like, oh, I'm going to call my machine gun down.
Yeah,
but then I've just like done a like 500 millimeter bomb right on
like
position.
A napalm strike. Yeah, right,
exactly.
On top of, yeah.
It's so funny.
I did spend a ridiculous amount of time when I realized that you can dive out the way of the things dropping at the last second. I spent a ridiculous amount of time trying to like time it as close as possible to dive
yeah.
through the drop. I did get clipped a few times.
I love it. Like the feeling of when you launch like the hell bomb, when you like do it and run away, even if you're outside of the blast radius, still getting rocked is like yeah. so cool. Like, ugh.
It's like shocking. When everyone was talking about this game, I quickly looked at some videos and I thought, it looks okay. Mm. Like, I didn't see the appeal, but it's one of those games you just have to play, isn't it? And then play it with your friends as well. It's such a good time, and I was desperate to play more. I wish I had the time to do it right now. And I was speaking to Alex about it as well, and Alex has, you know, two kids and potentially less time than I do. And he was like, I really want to play this game. I think it's absolutely up his alley as well.
Yeah.
Like his sort of game. So maybe
well,
we can bring
like
back...
he likes like emergent systems and stuff, like from a real Zelda background, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
this
yeah.
feels like it has that same like all of these things are all combining together to have a weird time.
Yeah. He also just really loves multiplayer shooters, like with playing with a team. Like when we used to work in the office, we play multiplayer shooters together every lunchtime. And so... yeah, kind of miss those days, and maybe we can bring them back, even if it's a couple of days a week or something.
It's so funny, you know, like a month ago, none of us would have said this, but now we're like, let's get all Helldivers. I was on last night, I was in a group of four people, I got an invite to another group of four people, and then separately another mate was already in a group with another four people. Like, that doesn't happen.
Oh, look at you, Helldiver friends.
So many friends, yeah.
I know people that play video games. I just mean that, like, that's spread out of, like, everybody would be otherwise be playing other stuff and they're not, they're playing Helldivers.
I would love it if they made it so you could play like eight player as well, like really ramp up your team and make obviously ramp up everything. I don't know if those maps are sort of like, it might be a bit packed out if there was like eight of you running around, but the idea of like a whole squad, huge squad of doing it. What I'm not seeing so far on my early look, it's a huge amount of variety in terms of the planets and stuff. I've been to a few different ones and I've seen the Terminators, I've seen the AT-STs, and then I've seen the bugs and stuff. Is that all I can expect, or is there more than that?
There are larger ones that you'll come across, like a Bile Spewer is like a really big guy that will take a long time to take down.
Right.
But yeah, I think that they've got a pretty good roadmap behind the scenes that they'll continue to add like weirder and weirder guys. Some of the leaks, which I think we'll still talk about because it's inevitable. Like people have been talking about how good it would be to have a mech in this, and apparently it's coming. Like I'm so excited.
Well, the technology and the weapons on offer are just all so much fun, and it does fill me with excitement to think in a year's time how much variety they're going to have in this game. You know, I desperately want to play more, but I only want to play it with other people. So
should do it at lunchtime. Let's go.
I'm trying to organize it. Or no, at lunchtime I'm on baby feeding duties usually, so I can't really do that. But we're in the office next week, but we won't have our consoles with us there, so we can't do that. But
we'll get the company to ship us in some PCs for some bonding.
I want to play more Helldivers 2. Something else, though, I want to play, and a trailer came out. I think it came out 2 weeks ago, last week, but part of IGN FanFest, we had an exclusive second trailer, was a game called Kingmakers. I know you two have seen Kingmakers, but I'm thinking some of the audience might not have, and I implore you to check these trailers out. So Kingmakers, on the surface... looks like a medieval RTS game with elements of third person combat in there as well. It's a sort of combo of the two. The wrinkle, or the extra fun part, is that you play as a time traveler from modern day who goes back with his entire arsenal in terms of machine guns, a jeep, Apache helicopters, and you can just dominate this entire medieval field. It's like the game that a kid would come up with when they're playing with their toys, and like one of them would be playing with their swords and stuff, and someone else would roll in with an AK-47 and just gun them all down.
It's one of those rare ideas where it takes somebody actually doing it to realize, like, oh, we could have done this the whole time.
It's right? mad, isn't it?
It's such a good idea that was like, yeah. Why has nobody thought about this? And yet, yeah.
Usually the best ideas are that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how has nobody thought about this at this point? I think so far this year, it's been a bit... I'm not that excited about all the games coming out this year, but this one really caught my interest. And I think right now, maybe that and Star Wars Outlaws might be my most excited game of the year. It's coming out this year, right? I think they did say it's coming.
If it's not next month, I'm always like, games are getting delayed. Like, I have no information to say that that's happening.
So this is from small independent studios. So yeah, there's a good chance. But then I think they did speak about a demo coming soon as well. So we could get a taste of it at least this year. What do you guys think? King's Vakers, are you into it?
I want it. Let's have it.
Yeah. What about you, Emma?
It looks really fun. I'd definitely try it. Like, just seeing, you know, they've got this really nice shot of like them out on a field and everyone's running, and suddenly a car just bursts in and it's like, this looks wild. I will never go at that.
That brief moment of what the future looks like as well was really cool. Like, I imagine that that's something that they'd try and explore a little bit as well.
It also made me think of like, what are other like trailers that have come out of nowhere and just like, you know, changed everyone's perception of like, what you're excited about this year? And I think like the opposite end of that is Helldivers, which is a game that no one seemed to give a shit about until it actually came out and then it became mega popular, where Kingmakers is the opposite effect potentially. What about you guys? Can you remember any?
I remember watching, it was an E3 one year, and there's this amazing game that... like a lad's just walking along, he's like skulking in this like rain fallen city, he's hacking stuff with his little phone and like stuff's popping up and you're able to just like I need to get in there, so I've like oh, and like some bollards, I can pull them up so that a car crashes into them, and I'm like, oh my god, what the hell is this? And then he pulls out a gun and I'm like, oh, it's a third person shooter, right? Okay. Yeah. It was Watch Dogs. I was so convinced that this was the future of what games could possibly do. And then at the end of the trailer, I'm like, oh, it's just going to be another one of these, isn't it?
Well, if you remember Watch Dogs, though, they were touting it as like the first next gen PS4 era game, I think it was.
Yeah.
And the graphics in the original trailer looked incredible. Like, they didn't look that good in the final game. It was that era of Ubisoft sort of like,
did it also even promising? Did it have the multiplayer thing that it was intending to
do? I'm just trying to think if that was in 2 or not, but it might have been 2. But they definitely had a companion app where you could control other people's cities and stuff. If someone was trying to escape, you could be the person who like firing off the bollards and lifting things and causing traffic jams and stuff. I did play a little bit. There was some element of multiplayer stuff. Watch Dogs 2 is great, by the way, but I know what you mean. There was that original promise of like, this is new, this is different, and then it did kind of, by the end of it, just feel like it's a new element to a familiar format.
I think.
There's been quite a few moments like that from Ubisoft, to be fair. I remember thinking The Division, when the first trailer Division, I thought this looked incredible, the idea of being able to experience that with all your friends and stuff. I'd never played like World of Warcraft or anything like that, so to me it was quite new, but yeah, it turned out to be not as exciting as perhaps what was promised. Anything from you, Emma?
There was something that I found really exciting. I think other people were probably just like, oh, this is really cool. But for me, it was like what got me into like the series for a game, and that was also like an E3 reveal. And that was Fallout 4. I'd never played 3 or, you know, the earlier ones as well. I know those are quite different. But I saw the trailer for Fallout 4 and I was like, whoa, this looks cool. Really like the style of it and the setting. And I was like, why have I not played these games before? And then immediately, like the next day, got 3, spent like the summer playing it. And I was just like, I'm in. This is really, really cool.
Well, Fallout 4 was the one where they announced it and then 6 months later it was coming out, right?
It was like, really quick. Yeah.
I remember that being so exciting, because the idea of like, normally, you know, they've regressed since then, because if you look at Elder Scrolls 6, they announce it and then, what, 18 years later, we might get to play it or something.
Yeah.
But with Fallout 4, they were so on top of it. Like, here it is, and we're ready in 6 months.
Come and think of it, I think I had this for Fallout 3, because I'd played Fallout 1 and 2, And I think it would have been Oblivion at that time. And so the combination of like, oh, it's this world that I kind of like, and a like game series that like it's going to be kind of exactly like. I remember that being around the same time that like video of stuff was really readily available as well. So I was like, a bunch of it came out at once and I was completely absorbing it in a way that I hadn't with a game before. Like that, yeah. That was a real like moment.
It's exciting, isn't it? And I feel like we don't always, especially from the AAA space, we don't see enough of it these days. Perhaps I think it's a lot of it's hidden in the indie space sometimes, and you have to dig them out. But yeah, trailers that just sort of change the game, and ones where you think like, this is something I've never seen before, is brand new. Let us know what you think. If you've got any of those, it's IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com. Write in with the trailers that change the game for you. Before we go to the ad, we are going to do an end. No, sorry. We are going to do an analyst search after the ad. But before I get to that, I just want to read out this email that we got from Josh Gallimore. And Josh says, happy Friday. I really enjoyed the chat about the old shows we used to watch, and I thought I'd weigh in with one I used to enjoy, but is seemingly no longer being made. There used to be this Unreal show, the name escapes me, but there would be a rotating cast of three people, and each week they'd have a segment where they'd play some kind of guessing game, usually based on video games, films, or TV. It aired for years. There were easily 200 plus episodes, and the theme tune was unbelievable, with late 90s garage welcoming in every show. Do you see where he's going? Mm.
Yeah, I think so.
But then it suddenly disappeared and the creators never mentioned it again. Eerie, right? It gets stranger. Around the time the show went off the air, segment went off the air, the show's host started receiving thinly veiled threats about the theme song and had some viewers warn that they'd boycott the segment show altogether. And it seemed the host bowed to the pressures, continuing to make episodes without ever mentioning the segment again. I wondered if you or the listeners also remember this show / segment, or was it just a figment of my imagination? What is he doing here? He's wrote imagination, but he's capitalized the G and the I and the N in the middle of it, but they're not in the right order, so it doesn't. Anyway, I'm concerned the hosts were being gagged, and it's a conspiracy from the inside.
Oh no, it's the capital I from imagination, not the gin.
But the G and the N is capitalized.
Yeah,
the beginning I, then G, then
the readers anyway. Can't, the listeners yeah. can't read this.
Yeah, they'll be like, what are you talking about?
Move on, yeah. Anyway, I've been searching endlessly for the answers, but I'm yet to find the solution. Josh, we get where you're coming from, got where you're coming from in the first few lines. It has not gone away, it has never gone away. I think it was more the case of we just had so many things to talk about, so many games, movies, TV shows to talk about, that we'd often run out of time. And what we don't want to do is create 2-hour, 3-hour podcasts, because we need to put the endless search in as well. Also, it's largely dependent on user submissions. So please do still send in your ideas for endless searches. And if we like them, if we think they work, and if we've got the time that week, we'll definitely play them. It's not going anywhere, don't worry. And after this ad break, you'll get to hear an endless search.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
And we are back, and it's time for the endless search.
Yeah, play, on the ones and twos.
Play the jingle.
Inside, it's the UK IGN crew. Yeah, on the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Hold tight, the DJ, we're coming through. Yeah, on the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. It's the endless search.
Okay, so I've come up with my own endless search league, because mainly because I read Josh's email, and I'm like, we're doing it this week, and I want to make sure it's something maybe a little bit new. I guess it's new. So I've called it the Wheel of Fantasy.
Ooh,
yes. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you're going to like the premise of it, considering what you said earlier about how many Final Fantasy games you've played.
Oh, no.
So it's because Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is out this week. I thought we'd do something a bit fun with Final Fantasy games, right? Let me bring up my doc. So, there has been 16 main Final Fantasy games, and all but two have lead protagonists, right? So, my idea, I've put all these names into a wheel, and I'm going to randomly spin the wheel and then present you a name, and you're going to have to tell me which Final Fantasy game they are from. There's 16 rounds, but because Final Fantasy 11 and 14 don't have main protagonists because they are MMO games, I've added in two different games, and I'm going to leave you to guess which ones they are.
Ooh, that's fun.
They're spin-off games of Final Fantasy.
I thought it would be like nothing, no. Even remotely. Like.
Yes, it's Joel
Ezio Auditore.
So also make this every extra fun. So what we're going to do is we're going to take it in turns. So Matt, I'll present you a name. Emma, I'll present you a name. We will have a steal opportunity. However, like Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, I think we're going to give you ATB charges of free slots to equip your steal materia. This is how much of a nerd I am. So you only get three times to say you want to steal the answer. So if you hear the name and you think, I've got this one, you can call steal. But you only get three goes at that. And 1 point for every answer. Let me get my wheel ready. I've got a separate wheel app, which is quite handy. And it's got all the names on it. Who wants to go first? Or should I toss one?
Yeah, I think you should toss a coin.
Yeah.
I don't have a coin to hand, but I do have a controller for a light that has okay. A back panel. So I'm just going to flip it.
Can I have buttons, please?
You want buttons? Okay. It's the back, so Emma's going first. Remember, you have three steel charges, so you can use them. But let us spin the wheel. Click to spin. Oh, I'm getting loads of sound effects. You guys aren't getting this. I'm getting a little wheel spinning sound effect. Oh, so some of these are going to be easy.
They're all the going to be hard for me.
The first name... You got to tell me which game they are in is Clive Rossfield.
Oh, Final Fantasy 16.
Correct. And Matt didn't jump in with a steal there. I really thought he was going to, but he's an honourable gentleman at the start.
I feel like, yeah, I'll give you one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's I need this one.
There's going to be a few easy ones, but then there's a few very tricky ones as well. Cool. Right, 1-0 to Emma. Next spin. I really need to mute this browser because this spinning noise is annoying.
I've just realized we could run into the problem of like, oh, is it the North American Final Fantasy 3 or is it... No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I didn't do that. No. Right. So the next one is for Matt, Lunith.
I think that's... What? Two.
I'm afraid you're wrong.
No.
It is Final Fantasy 3.
Ugh.
So still 1-0 to Emma. Emma, this is your spin. The spin takes a while. I'm removing names as I go. So, oh my God. Okay. Right. This name is Bart Clauser.
Oh my gosh.
Steel.
Okay.
Right, go for it.
I think it's six, isn't it?
It is Final Fantasy V.
Ugh,
Matt.
Damn.
So you've, Matt is down one steel. Right, next one. I wish this wheel spun faster because it gets dead air situations. Oh, okay. And so the next one for Matt is Squall Leonhart.
I'm going to go with eight.
It is eight. Matt knew that one straight away, obviously. Right, next spin for Emma. Oh, look at that. It is Squall again, so let's just remove that, and it goes down to the next one. I didn't remove it.
I wonder which one that could be.
I've removed it now. It's gone, and it's gone to the next one, which, Emma, it is Cloud Strife.
I'm not going to steal. It's too rude.
Yeah. There's a few like that where, yeah. You are correct, Emma. It is Cloud Strife. It didn't remove it for some reason, but it might come up again. We'll see. The next one for Matt is Terra Branford.
I think this is from one of the side games, isn't it?
I can't possibly answer that.
Yeah, let's say a side game. Do I have to guess? Is it from Type Zero?
It is not Type Zero. It is from Final Fantasy VI.
Ugh.
Next spin for Emma. Let's see what name we get. Oh, okay. We get Cecil Harvey.
I'm just going to guess because I have no idea. Nine?
It is not nine. It was from Final Fantasy IV.
Oh, okay.
I feel like I could have stolen for process of elimination.
Yeah,
on that one.
No one, you're being quite honourable, both of you. But, ooh, okay. Now this is where things get. No, it's not. Okay. So it does this really like slow tick where you think it's going to land on thing and it goes to the next one. The next one is Noctis Lucis. Don't know how to pronounce the last name. Noctis.
This one's me, right?
Yes.
15.
It is 15. Correct. Next spin. Oh, okay. Emma, do you know which Final Fantasy Lightning is the main character in?
Steel.
Yeah.
It's 13, please.
It is 13. Matt gets it. And Emma, yeah, don't worry. You said 10.
I would have been wrong anyway.
You would have been wrong.
Am I out of steals or have I got one more?
You've got one more steel.
Okay.
Oh, this one. Is it going to be this one? Yeah. Okay, this one's a tricky one. So this one is The Warriors of Light.
That's Final Fantasy One.
It is Final Fantasy One. Yes. So Final Fantasy One doesn't actually have, yes, a protagonist. It just has a group of people. Right. And the next one, Emma, is Van.
12?
It is 12.
It is
12.
Yeah.
Is it Van or Van? I don't know.
I think it's Van.
Yeah. It's two A's. So
although some people would say Balthier.
Well, I'm only going off what the Wikipedia is. Right. Okay. I think we've got like five left now. And it's 4-3 to Matt. And now we have got Firion. Matt?
I'm going to say that's from Final Fantasy Tactics.
It is not from Final Fantasy Tactics. It's from Final Fantasy 2.
Ah, well.
Emma, what Final Fantasy game is Tidus from?
9.
Oh, no. I'm afraid it's 10.
Ah, I should have gone 10.
Yes.
I'm saving my steel.
Right, we've got three left. Well, it's four on the wheel because I haven't deleted Cloud off it yet. But there's three left. It's going to land on Cloud, isn't it? Of course it is. Yeah. Right, can we remove that now this time? Remove it. Right, spin again. Yeah, there's three left. And I will say two of these are the spin-off games. Matt, you've got an easy one, you bastard. Which one game is Zidane Tribal from?
He's from 9, mate.
He is from 9. Matt, you've got 5
points.
Thanks
for the layup.
Right. It's two left, and they are both the spin-off games. So these are the two tricky ones. Emma, you've got 3 points. Matt's got 5 points. Emma, you have got to tell me which game Jack Garland is in.
Steel.
Oh, Matt's used his final steel. What
it's
is it,
Stranger in Paradise.
It is Strangers of Paradise. Matt gets 6 points. So Matt's won. But the last one, for fun, is Vincent Valentine. Any idea, either of you?
I feel like
it's from Dirge of Cerberus.
It is Dirge of Cerberus, yeah. So Emma, he is from Final Fantasy VII, but he's not the main character in VII. But he is the main character in Dirge of Cerberus. Matt, 7-3 to Matt. You absolutely killed it.
Good job, Matt. Yeah.
Turns out I know everything about Final Fantasy.
I will be honest, Emma. I thought you might have played a couple of the games at least. So I'm really sorry.
But by pure random chance, you did still get 3 points, which is a good indication.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, some of them, like, I guess it was, which ones did you get? Cloud. You got...
So 7, 16.
You got Van. And,
yeah, Van.
Yeah. So fair play. Good round. Right. We are going to
check out Final Fantasy if you get the chance.
I've heard it's all right. Yeah.
Should probably try it. I've tried 16 actually, but I bounced off it.
Many did.
Yes. Yeah. 16 looks even... worse. Not as good compared to Rebirth as well. I'd definitely say play Remake and Rebirth over 16 any day. What have we got? Feedback, Emma, you are up first.
Yep. So our second piece actually is from Jamie Martin. Jamie says, "Hello, pod people. We're having a conversation in the Facebook group the other day and I wanted to get your opinion too. What do you consider the golden age of gaming? I'll leave how you define it up to you, but what's the most hallowed gaming generation for you?" Jamie says, "I think for me, it's the PS2 GameCube era. It was a formative era in terms of me discovering new games and genres. A lot of time spent wandering the aisles of game, but more than that, I feel like it's the basis of modern gaming was established. Modern game design, standardized control schemes, visual styles, etc. I feel like it can all be tracked back to sixth generation. What say you? The C's respect is both warranted and required." Thanks, Jamie.
I think Jamie kind of like summed up for me that the golden age is the era where you were a kid, when you first really got into games. So whatever works for you, but that's a bit of a boring answer, I guess. For me, I feel like it's maybe the PS2 generation as well, but maybe the like PS3, Xbox 360 generation, which I think really sort of took AAA games to the next level, I would say. I don't know. How about you two? What do you think?
For me, like, I really love that era as well. Like, it had a lot of experimentation in like really big games in a way that you couldn't get. Like, there's no way that you're getting Parappa the Rapper or anything now, right?
No.
But I think for me, the most important time, that golden age, is the Xbox Live Arcade era.
Right.
So you know, every other week you'd get something like Braid or Bastion or Super Meat Boy or Limbo or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, amazing games that were probably only possible because of that digital delivery system.
Yeah.
Like, that's my time.
Yeah, I guess you've got to consider what do you think was like the revolutionary step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also with that era, with the Xbox Live era, what was the HD era as well, when we first, like, you know, got these clear looking imagery, and it changed the game a bit. But then you could also argue, you know, the jump to PS1 and N64 era was like such a revolutionary change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has it for me. Yeah. Like, PS1, you had like Metal Gear Solid, Tomb Raider, like Resident Evil 2, Tony Hawk. Like, that was such a massive time for like PS1. And then like on PC as well, you had like sort of in the 90s, you had Half-Life, Doom, Rollercoaster Tycoon, which was amazing. Yeah. And yeah, sort of like right at the tail end of that period, I was playing so much of like The Sims as well. So yeah, I think for me, like PS1, sort of not like late 90s specifically.
Yeah.
I think in a few years' time, we're going to look back on like, you know, this time as being a pretty special time. Like last year, we had so many massive games, like Baldur's Gate 3, Tears of the Kingdom, CS2, like, last year felt really special, I think. And I think we'll look back definitely and think like 2023 was
definitely one of those years. Yeah. Yeah.
I think you could argue like we are in the, you know, the golden generation right now because of just the sheer volume and quality and polish that we get and the options and the variety. But then what maybe there isn't in this generation is the revolution, I suppose. It depends what you consider.
Let's see when Kingmaker comes out.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But it feels like very much an extension of the PS4, Xbox One era in terms of like things are just a bit better made, I guess. But the same ideas still exist, really. But like you said, like Baldur's Gate and Zelda last year, two absolutely revolutionary games. So yeah, like, I'm sure we'll consider, we'll look back fondly in 10 years time at this era as well. Matt, you've got the next email from Luke.
I do. It's from Luke Smith, who says, "Hey all, hope you're doing great. Two fun things before I get into the meaty bit. First, my brother's friend was one of the first people to compete the Way of the Warrior on Raven. I remember finding out when I was a kid, my brother freaking out when he found out before it aired. Secondly, Jeopardy, which we talked about on a previous episode, which is not the American game show with the reverse answer questions. Jeopardy was genuinely terrifying, but also super unique. When the final episode was about to air the following week, CBBC put out an ad that said there were multiple endings. The only ending with the most votes would be shown on TV. Ooh. There were three, I believe. Happy, surprising, and scary. No shock that the scary ending was the winner. Few months of trauma for me as I watched those kids discover they too were infected. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Actually, before I get to this next part as well, has anybody seen the trailer for I Saw the TV Glow?
No.
Oh, it looks wicked. Yeah, I'm going to share that in the chat with you afterwards. But yeah, okay. It's a new A24 that's coming out. My show callback I want to speak about is Scary Sleepover, a show in which three kids were locked in a mansion all alone at night and had to complete challenges and survive the scares to win prizes. The night would get scarier by the hour, and the final 5 minutes every object would come alive and do their best to traumatize them.
Oh my god.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
However, if even one of them hit the panic button, the game would immediately end, and all three friends would lose. The challenges ranged from crawling through ripe cobweb-filled spaces to traveling through flooded basements and more. Such a fun concept that people don't remember. Keep up all the amazing work, you're all incredible. Respect the sea otters. All best, Luke. Is that us, by the way? Are we the sea otters?
I don't know.
I'm going to say that we are.
We could be the sea otters, or maybe the audience are sea otters.
That's true. Yeah, you're all sea otters now.
That show sounds like a health and safety nightmare.
Yeah.
Like getting children to crawl through flooded basements and stuff.
Did anybody
see... The 90s and early 2000s were a different time for TV for kids, weren't they? Like, there were so many shows like that where it was like challenges and stuff that would never be allowed now, I don't think.
No one's getting gunged anymore.
I was just thinking that. I was like, what happened to sliming and gunging?
Gunging. It's all health and safety, isn't it, these days? Can't gunge anyone. Did anybody see The Traitors, by the way?
Did you watch
The Traitors, the show? The
no, is that
show?
Related to this?
There was a scene in one of the most recent, on one of the further episodes in this most recent series that was kind of this, where there was like a tunnel that they had to all go through, but it was like a trauma house where like the lights would go out if one person wasn't holding the button and people would throw fish guts and stuff.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was gross.
My era of this sort of... Wacky Nonsense was like Funhouse and stuff, so it's quite a long time ago. I haven't seen any of the shows since then, so I'm not the best to talk about these sort of shows. But yeah, bring back Gungeon, I say. Why not?
We should make pins with that.
Bring back Gungeon.
Badges.
Yeah. Cool. All right. It's me doing the last email. This is from Lawrence McLean. He says, "Aloha, gents. Lawrence here, emailing all the way from Hawaii. I recently watched a YouTube clip, I can't recall the source, where they mention these actors who sign on for Sony Spider-Man films that aren't aware that the two, Disney and Sony MCU, are different from one another. Whether it's Sony or their agent telling them that they're looking for a Marvel character, I don't know. Not mentioning it's Sony, not Disney. Do you guys think it's on the actor to know the difference, or on the agent or Sony to tell them? I mean, at the end of the day, as an actor, which I'm not, as long as they get paid, I don't care. But there are some who enter thinking that they're going to be a part of something bigger and leave muddying the waters even further and contribute to superhero fatigue, which I don't think really exists. People are just tired of these god-awful movies. Anyway, wanted to get your thoughts. Mahalo."
I remember they talked about this a little bit on an episode of The Weekly Planet, so I'm going to say that that's the source. Good shout out to those boys.
What do they call it? They call it the Spum. Spum Universe.
And so I think they're talking about specifically Dakota Fanning for this one, but I don't know if that's necessarily true, but it feels right.
The onus falls on the actor and agent a little bit, I guess. Mm. But also they're signing contracts and, like, it's not like they're just they show up one day and then they start shooting, you know, like there's lots of prep work that goes into hiring these actors and stuff. And I'm sure, you know, ultimately they have to consider, weigh up these decisions, not only for the immediate pay, but the consequences of their career as well. So I'm sure they're quite au fait with what the whole process is and what they're actually working on. But saying that, is working in the MCU these days such like,
yeah, like is it much different thing? In
yeah
terms.
Like
yeah.
Consider if you were in like the Marvels, for example, is that any different from to being in Madame Web, really? Unless the idea is we're laying the groundwork for you being in this film because you're going to be in future films and you're going to be in an Avengers film, then obviously I can understand that, you know, there's a big thing there.
We've got a great role for you, Jared. You're going to be Morbius.
Yeah. That's also the tricky thing is, for some actors, you see it, you've seen it a lot recently, a lot of them are repeating, like, or not repeating, but they've already had a role in the MCU and now they've got a different role in the MCU. And it's like, what is it when you commit to a role in the MCU, that's you for the rest of your career? Like, that's a decision you might not want to take lightly as well. Saying that, in 10 years' time, it'll probably all be rebooted and you can have another go at it anyway. But I saw somebody saying that cousin from The Bear, what's his name, Ebon Moss?
Bacharach.
He was in The Punisher, I think, or something like
that. Yeah, he's Micro.
Yeah. So he's getting a second crack at the whip. So, you know, there's hope for everybody, I guess.
I guess even Ryan Reynolds, most famously.
Mm.
Oh, no, I'm thinking Chris Evans. Chris Evans is the one.
Yeah, Ryan Reynolds was in DC when he was in Green Lantern. And then, but Chris Evans it wasn't the MCU when it was Fantastic Four back then, I suppose. So that kind of makes sense. But anyway, let us know if you have thoughts on that or anything else that we spoke about on the podcast today. It's IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com. And I think that's it for the podcast. Have we got any ideas for music, what we can play at the end? What's a Shogun theme like?
Unremarkable, honestly. Although it is by it's by Atticus Ross of working with Trent Reznor fame. So we could segue in again some Nine Inch Nails on there if you want.
Nine Inch Nails. Let's do it. We're playing Nine Inch Nails. All right, take care. Bye.
Bye.
Catch you later. You're keeping in still.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.